Let's start with the current situation of the conflict in Ukraine. We have a new administration in Russia, the new Putin's administration, and he's putting an economist as the head of the defense ministry. It's so amazing what's going on in Russia and why they're doing this. And on the other hand, you see the battleground is not much in favor of Ukraine and the United States. And Anthony Blinken was there talking with Zelensky. How do you find the current situation right now?
I find it incredibly difficult every day, every week, the danger of Ukrainian collapse grows. Some of it was inevitable. Some of it is because of the poor decision making, the lack of wisdom, the lack of forethought, or the willingness or desire, or the being beholden to, I guess I should say, the fear of the news cycle, that we have to show that we're making progress. We have to, lie through our teeth. And if we can't do that, we've got to demonstrate it somehow. So, I mean, you see this what happened referring to the expansion of the war further in Kharkiv Oblast, as the Russian army came across the border and has taken, I don't know, a dozen or so villages. The important thing about this, of course, is that it's elongated the front lines. So the front lines didn't stretch all the way through Kharkiv, through the province of the oblast. I mean, it's the Russian-Ukraine border is something like 1,400 miles, and the war is only about 600 miles long. So there's plenty for this war to expand. I mean, plenty of distance it can go. And the idea that Russia is just doing this because this is the next phase of their operation and everything else, and maybe at some in some ways it is, but it's also reacting to the cross border attacks by Ukraine into the Belgorod region of Russia. And so the Russians, of course, come across the border to prevent those further attacks into Russia and create basically what the Russians have said very clearly is a buffer zone. And so what I'm getting at is that the lack of forethought on the Ukrainians and NATO to say, if we continue with these attacks into Russia, trying to score morale points on our side, trying to score some type of propaganda victories, maybe some of these fools have the thoughts that somehow this would despair, this would cause the Russian people to fall into despair and give up on the war, But, I mean, this idea that they didn't have the forethought to think, okay, what happens next? Particularly once the Russians start saying, we're going to come in and create a buffer zone, and they still, more or less keep poking the bear, if you will. And so, like that type of decision making, we can talk about, however many more examples like that. That's kind of just more the recent one, shows us how it's just not the inevitability of the war, right? In fact, you've got a much smaller, weaker nation up against a much, not just larger and better resource, but better prepared nation, and also a better leadership in Russia, in the sense that they are adaptive, they do change, they th see things aren't going well, they make corrections in a manner that we're not seeing coming from Ukraine or from NATO and the US. So, I mean, that's how, now Russia, of course, is in a position where it has this greater weight, these greater resources. The Wall Street Journal this week just reported that in the last 6 months, Russia has been able to fire 45% more missiles and drones, right? And that's not aberration. That's because of the Russian defense industrial base is able to produce these types of things. And there's the only thing you can conclude is that it's going to improve its production capacity. And there's every reason to believe that's the case. So, I mean, Russia certainly has a strength here, but they're also stuck in many ways, in the sense that the further west Russia pushes, the more occupied territory they take. The further west they go from they're growing into a population that has a greater number of Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians than it does Russian-speaking Ukrainians. And so they go from what loosely described as liberators to occupiers the further west they go. And so this is a quandary, because now you're fighting both a conventional war on your front lines, and behind that in the rear, you're facing an insurgency. And this is what many in the West dreamed would happen, that this would somehow be some type of swift victory by Russia. They rush in, take all of Ukraine, and then have to deal with this partisan warfare, this guerrilla warfare. You know, no one less than Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, when she was asked about the war early on in February 24, her response was, you know, basically to suggest that we hope that this becomes another Afghanistan to the Russians. You know, we could do to them what we did to the Soviets. So like the Russians themselves are in a position that it's a favorable position. If this continues as a war of attrition, they are in a much better position than the Ukrainians in the West. But there's also the danger of, you know, what do you do with what you've won? And if we go back to what their immediate goals were in 2022, which we saw carry out through the negotiations during that period between Ukraine and Russia, we see that occupying a good portion or most or all of Ukraine was certainly not the Russians' goals. And so how do they keep themselves from being put into a position where that becomes their reality, right? So, I mean, that's a question the Russians have to figure, you know, how do we preclude, how do we bring this to a close in a way that we get what we are looking for, and we're not encumbered with an occupation or an endless war or a collapsed Ukraine, you know, which basically you've got this collapsed, destroyed, ruined nation on your front doorstep. I mean, that's not a position that any nation wants. So, I mean, that's very long-winded, but, you know, I think it's an uneasy situation, and it's with the dangers of escalation. There are no apparent victors outright, but there are also victors in many smaller ways. You know, we'll have to always bring up the fact that for the Americans, victory has come in the sense that the U.S. has gained the liquid natural gas market for its companies, right? I mean, something that wasn't the case 3 years ago. So, that's another way to look at it as well, too, is not just, I guess, in the overall greater interests, but also in these partisan, parochial, institutional interests, you know, that make up so much of what's occurring.
But it seems that Russia has already achieved what they wanted to achieve, and they're waiting for some sort of political will in the West, in Ukraine, the Western part of Ukraine, to go after some sort of negotiations, because right now we don't see any sign of negotiation.
This idea that they could just ruined Western Ukraine, possibly, I guess they could have, but why would they think that would win the war from them? Why would that deliver what they're looking for? And I think maybe rather than using the word victory to describe what the Russians are looking for, I think success might be a better way to describe it. Victory in the sense of destroying Western Ukraine, rubbling it, ruining it, would not have caused the Ukrainian government to quit, would not have caused them surrender, not these people. And it certainly would not have caused NATO to give up on this on this effort of theirs. So the Russians knew that. You have to do then is occupy all of Ukraine. The Russians don't have the army for it. I mean, they just don't have the manpower. In 2 years of war, Russia has taken approximately 20%, about approximately 10%. Of pre-invasion Ukraine.
What you're mentioning, it's totally right. But why Russia would go to the western part of Ukraine? But they wouldn't have anything to do with the western part of Ukraine.
Right. They wouldn't. Again, this gets back to, yeah, exactly, right? This idea of what does success look like for Russia and occupying all of Ukraine, having garrison in it, and then still having now all of NATO that would view retaking Ukraine as their mission, their purpose in life, right? I mean, so now you've given this organization that was on its way out before 2022, you know, had no purpose. It tried to find purpose in Afghanistan and Libya. Saw how that worked. That you know, I mean, you gave it purpose with this invasion. You know, I mean, so the Russians were you know, are aware of that, you know, and they're aware of an open-ended struggle, you know, an open-ended war, the consequences of that. That's why they went for such a quick and limited operational plan in 2022, you know, a main effort in the Donbass, a supporting effort towards Kyiv, whose purposes were not to capture the capital, but to push the Ukrainians to the negotiating table and pull troops away from eastern Ukraine. So, I mean, like, you look and see, even see what they did in the beginning of this war 26, 27 months ago, right? You know, as well as to look at their conduct of towards the war that preceded this aspect of the war we're talking about, because I tend to do that, unfortunately, speak as if February 2022 was some magical start date, you know, February 24th of that month was some magical start date, and everything else that came before it didn't really matter or play into it and everything. And that's completely not the case. As we know, 14,000 people were killed in eastern Ukraine from 2014 to 2022. About 4,000 or 5,000 of them were civilians. You know what I mean? So there was this nasty, brutal civil war occurring there, you know, that had been ameliorated, had been mitigated in great ways by the Minsk II Accords. And so we see how the Russians handled that period of time where they looked for limited objectives. Their goals weren't to conquer all of Ukraine. I mean, they never have been, in spite of the protests and the exclamations from the West. But I mean, certainly, yeah, this idea that Russia is interested in, you know, this idea of conquering all of Ukraine, that's their objective. You know, I mean, the thing about it, though, for them, where they're in danger of being stuck now, is if there's no political will to negotiate in the West, and the West decides that we're comfortable spending $100 billion all told every year on this war, as long as it keeps the balloon inflated, the house of cards upright, you know, as long as we think we can, you know, manage Ukraine's government and economy so it doesn't collapse, provide enough munitions and have enough troops, we'll send back the 900,000 Ukrainian men over in our countries. We're going to send them all back. You know, we'll keep this thing going. You know, now if the Russians are, that's what they're stuck in, right? You know, that is not what their plans were, to have this open-ended conflict, this forever war in Ukraine, this multi-year war at a minimum. You know, that was not because the goal was these limited objectives. But I think it's better, again, to think about what's the success look like for the Russians. And it doesn't look like a ruined Ukraine. It looks like a solution for the issues in eastern Ukraine, whether that was an independent republic for the Donbass, whether it was some type of semi-autonomous region, you know, whatever it looked like, you know, the ruination of the rest of Ukraine did not help that at all. You know, so we have to be careful in the sense of advocating for those things, because that was not the Russian goal. And it doesn't make sense to have been the Russian goal, because it simply would have, you know, was simply not going to be a benefit to them to see that country ruined, you know, tens and tens of millions of refugees, et cetera.
How do you see this type of movement on the part of China and Russia in Europe? And if one of these countries, let's assume Serbia, joins BRICS, that would hugely affect what's going on in Europe.
Right. It's this kind of like the poor decision making and the lack of forethought with what's occurring in Ukraine. I think you could bring that to speak about the global order, if you will, right? This what is a increasingly hastened process of the American Empire being dismantled. And the way that the U.S. has handled the maintenance of its empire, in the sense of the political order that falls underneath its umbrella, in its bullying, its lecturing, its use of right war and torture, economic warfare, has caused that desire to get out from underneath the United States' umbrella to really quicken. And so here comes the rising empire, China. And they see all these nations that either have been directly harmed by the U.S. empire or that feel that being a part of it is increasingly becoming disadvantages, right? I mean, in the sense that, like, take nations like Hungary and Serbia. Well, Serbia's history after the Cold War ended, of course, one of horror and terror and atrocity and war, you know, as well as being victimized. But, you know, take a nation like Hungary, you know, in the 90s, their desire to align with the U.S., be part of the American empire, and the opportunity that they believed would come from that. And of course, what the reality is that you're part of the best. You're on the back benches of a mafia organization, right? I mean, and so the Hungarians have realized that, and they also see that at any point, if our policies do not align with what the United States is demanding and directing, then we can be subject to these same, you know, sanctions essentially that we have seen across the board. Now, the opportunity then for a nation like China to come along and not just build its empire, if you will, for lack of a better term, but its presence, or to build a newly created world, or a reimagined world, however you want to describe this. You know, I mean, the opportunity for China to come along and find disaffected nations like Hungary and Serbia in the middle of Europe, and to bring them on board to their efforts, right? I mean, so there's that opportunity that presents itself for the rising power to find these nations that are so dissatisfied with being a part of the American empire. And that, of course, just allows for this alternative to continue to be built, particularly BRICS, right, to replace, you know, at first provided to be an alternative, but then ultimately to replace, I would believe, the American empire, the American system, the American order. And so, yeah, I mean, it would be very fun to watch, right? It'd be really interesting to observe all this if we were simply adjacent to it, that it wasn't actually going to concern us. But the American empire is not going to die without a fight, without a struggle. And we saw today Joe Biden announce a list of tariffs on Japanese products that just make what Donald Trump did seem, you know, innocuous, seem meaningless.
On Chinese,
right? I mean,
on Chinese,
on China, yeah, on a China, right? Exactly. So this is the danger for us. Is like, it'd be great if we could watch this struggle of empire as if we were watching a show on Netflix. But this is going to have profound implications for all of us, and in particular, say, so as we were talking earlier before about, say, the rains that are destroying, you know, doing so much damage and causing so much harm to the land and the people in the south of your country. You know, I mean, and as we go into this world with artificial intelligence, with climate change, I just read this thing about you know, our birth rates are declining, you know, so as we have all these various challenges from all aspects of life, you know, in the sense of things we've created, either like AI or things we've caused like climate change or things that may occur that we don't have an answer for, like a declining birth rate. You mean we have to cooperate. And what we're seeing as we enter into this very dangerous phase of humanity is not just reluctance to cooperate, but the setting up of structures that make cooperation very difficult, right? So as we dismantle these international institutions, which the United States is just taking a wrecking ball to, you know, particularly with regards to Israel. So a wrecking ball to international institutions as well as international law. You know, we also see these efforts to dismantle the American empire through the rise of these other institutions, these rise of new relationships and friendships that the American empire will react very harshly to. So I'm not saying that the American empire shouldn't be dismantled. I'm not saying that these alternative institutions and systems shouldn't be created. Of course they should. But the problem is the danger, that transition, and how the American empire is going to fight against it. And that's going to make things very, very dangerous for us all.
And you talk about Israel, and we see that the Netanyahu administration is so insisting on attacking Rafah right now.
The story today was the heaviest days of bombing that they'd seen since October. So the fact that not shipping that one shipment of bomb, which is still the White House is claiming it's a shot fired across the Israelis' bow. The Israelis, you know, will make a stink about it. But in the end, it's all meaningless because it doesn't do anything to really affect Israel's abilities. Juxtaposed to that, though, say, take this, the resistance that the Israelis have run into going back into, say, northern Gaza, into the Jabalia refugee camp. Al Jazeera this morning reported that Al-Qassam and Al-Quds brigades said that they conducted 35 attacks against the Israelis in the Jabalia refugee camp. Now, say that's exaggerated, right? And say it's exaggerated by a factor of three. You know, it's only one third of those actually occurred. That's still a tremendous amount of military action against the occupiers by the resistance. And it shows that 7 months later, because, you know, that this resistance, this insurgency, these Hamas and PIJ forces are still resilient. They're still there. They're still able to function and operate in a combined, coordinated fashion. What has Israel actually accomplished? You know, I mean, so as the White House tries to get some type of political gain out of claiming it didn't send a shipload of bombs to Israel, while the whole time nodding and winking towards Israel to let them know it's all going to be okay in the future, because that's what they've been jumping up and down. You know, the American ambassador to Israel, Jack Lew, he said, you know, yesterday, the day before, I mean, he was basically, you know, if he was there, he couldn't have been more assertive or more overt or more wild in his effusive nature and effusive statements of support for Israel. You know, I mean, so, you know, I mean, they're doing everything they can to try and use this non-shipment of a set of bombs as, you know, out of both sides of their mouth, right? So trying to claim shows how tough the Biden administration is, trying to keep some votes from falling out of their hands, which they've already fallen out of their hands. At the same time, too, trying to make sure the Israelis and the Israel lobby and all its supporters in the U.S. aren't put off by this.
There is a new article in BBC, and they're talking about Iranian proxies. They're talking about Houthis, Hezbollah, and Hamas. I don't believe that any of them is in the hand of Iran. Iran may provide them with weapons, but they're not deciding on based on what Iran's saying to them. How do you find this relationship between Iran and these groups?
Groups that, of course, have very real relationships stretch back decades in the course of, say, Hezbollah and Iran. There's no doubt. There's no denying that in the early 80s, as Hezbollah formed, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps was there in Lebanon, and that there was a relationship. But that is, you know, it doesn't matter too much in the sense of why Hezbollah formed. They formed because Israelis invaded southern Lebanon. And they were completely brutal to the people. When Israel invaded southern Lebanon, it was 82, the Lebanese people are, they're not thrilled about it, but they're not adamantly, hostily, you know, violently against it, because they had their own issues with the Palestinians that Israel had invaded to root out. But very quickly, the Israelis had made enemies of the southern Lebanese, of the Shia there, and that forms Hezbollah. So whatever type of argument you want to make about the connections between Hezbollah and, say, Iran, there are connections, but they're allies. They have They see a common purpose in working together. They have a common enemy. They see common threats. They may have common goals, what they want to see occur, you know, in the region. But the idea that somehow you get back to it's all done by Iran, that Iran is some type of puppet master and they control Hezbollah and Hamas and Ansar Allah in Yemen, and you know, as well as all the Assad, Bashar Assad in Syria is essentially a paid member of the Iranian government, you know, like all that type of stuff, you know, that's just the political posturing, the narrative, the media messaging by the West to somehow make it seem as if the West has to have this continued presence in the Middle East because there are bad people there that need to be kept down. This gets back to the motif as, you know, say the United States, the American Empire, as the world's policeman, as the world's sheriff. We have to be there, otherwise bad things are going to happen. And the way you really sell that is to have some cartoon type villain, like the Iranians say, who have so much control that they're able to use all these proxy forces around the region to attack American interests, because that's the way it has to be. Because if you're going against the American empire, it can't be because the American empire is illegitimate or it's an occupier or it's putting in place cruel and terrible despots. You know, it must be because you're being paid to attack the empire. It's very similar to the arguments you see being made in the U.S. right now with the protests on the college campuses, the pro-Palestine, anti-war, anti-genocide protests. You know, I mean, you see, you know, speculation, but basically attacks on those protesters as being organized by outside groups. You know, that it's outside agitators who have come in and are causing these problems. They're coming in and they're radicalizing and brainwashing people. It's, you know, you see all the usual conspiracy theories. It's George Soros coming in with his money. And that's why three of those tents are the same color. You know, I mean, like all this, because it has to be a malign, a nefarious outside influence that's brainwashing them, directing them, controlling them, again, like a puppet master. It can't be that there actually is a genocide occurring, right? So the reason they protest is because they're paid to, or because they're too stupid to know anything. And then they're, you know, they're tricked into believing or manipulated and believing these things. Right? I mean, it can't be because, again, the United States is supporting, you know, is basically not supporting, but helping carry out a genocide, you know, in the same way that, you know, these groups like Hezbollah, Hamas, Ansar Allah, the Islamic resistance in Iraq, et cetera, they can't be doing this because they're opposed to occupation or they're opposed to genocide. It has to be because they're being paid, that they're proxies, you know. And so it's you know, you see that a similar type of propaganda be used both domestically and overseas. And so I guess if you're going to find a conspiracy in any of this, you can find a conspiracy there.
How do you see the situation in the West Bank right now? What they're doing, what's their official policy in the West Bank? How do you find the relationship between Israel and Mahmoud Abbas?
Well, I think with regards, yeah, to the Palestinian Authority, you know, and their leadership of Abbas, you know, it's a collaborative relationship. You know, when I was in the West Bank in 2017, of course, people spoke very badly about the Israeli occupation, but they spoke even worse about the Palestinian Authority, you know, because the Israelis were occupiers, the Palestinian Authority were collaborators. You know, so there is this dislike for the PA and for Fatah, the political party, the successor to the PLO, essentially, or it is the PLO that, you know, runs the PA. Yeah, they're viewed as corrupt. They're viewed as collaborators, that they're untrustworthy, that they don't have the best interests of the Palestinian people, you know, and that they are in many ways the cause, as are the Israelis. And, you know, and quite rightly so, the West for enabling all this, for this occupation to be in its 67 in its 57th year. So You know, I think with the Israelis, it's interesting to see the Israeli response, because I think you could see how the Israelis were taken flat-footed, were by surprise by October 7th. Because if they had had a good, if they had foreseen it, or if they had kind of prepared for it, I think they would have been more organized in what they're doing in the West Bank. I mean, they're doing a lot in the West Bank. They've been incredibly aggressive in the West Bank, both the military, the border police, you know, as well as, of course, the settlers. You've seen thousands of Palestinians in the West Bank arrested, held without detention. I think the numbers of detained West Bank Palestinians are closing in on 10,000 now. And so you see as well Palestinians being driven from their homes, you know, the settlers really allowed to, you know, as well as in the Israeli military using this as an opportunity to crack down on any type of organized resistance in the West Bank, including nonviolent resistance. I know I have friends who are part of the nonviolent resistance in West Bank, and they have all been detained. Fortunately, they've been released, but other family members have not been. I mean, so, but what you don't see is kind of what you would expect the Israelis to have. And this is why this idea that all these governments have these prepared plans on the shelf and they pull them off and they open them up and they go right to it, you know, because you'd think that they would have taken better advantage of the circumstances of the situation to take more of a structural control over the West Bank. And maybe that's got to do because they don't want to do that. They don't want that problem. They don't want that complication. They know that that way lies real danger. They don't, I mean, one of the things they don't also, one of the other things is they don't want to have a third intifada in the West Bank. They just don't feel they have the ability to control that right now. And that will go against their interests. You know, I mean, so I think what you're seeing is they're trying to exploit, of course, the situation of Gaza as best they can. This is a chance to, you know, carry out, you know, the next phase of the creation of Greater Israel, of an ethnic, of this ethnic cleansing campaign against Palestinians that goes back over 100 years. You know, I mean, so, but I think they are limited in the sense that they know that how much they can accomplish, what they're going to be able to control. They can control this genocide, this ethnic cleansing, this collective punishment of the Palestinians in Gaza. They can't control both that and a third intifada in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, right? So I think you've seen where this is kind of a statement that I think people would, you know, be surprised at, in the sense that you're seeing a controlled Israeli response. It's not as, again, not planned like you'd expect. And certainly what comes out of that control, the beating, the burning of homes, the torture, the murder of Palestinians, is not what you call, you know, controlled in the sense of something calm and orderly, you know, particularly when it's being carried out by the settlers. But it's being done in a way so as not to let things get out of control to the point that the Israeli military, their police forces, security services, the government becomes overextended with not just what's happening in Gaza, not just what's happening on the Lebanese border, you know, where you still have over 100,000 Israelis who've been displaced from their homes. Remember, Israel's only about 9 million people, so 100,000 is a lot of people, plus the, I think it's a close to an equivalent number displaced from the south. I mean, so you have so many things. And then, of course, issues with Iran, attacks from Iraq, from Syria, Yemen. I mean, the blockade, the economic distress Israel's under. And so you see, I think, the Israelis saying, you know, internally, okay, we can't let what's happening in the West Bank out of control. But same time, too, we have to maximize our ability to exploit the situation as we can. And so we've seen what I think most of us would say is a limited power, a land grab, power grab, you know, in the West Bank, you know, certainly not limited if you live there, of course, but compared to, I think, what we would expect, it's not as substantial as, you know, and particularly compare that to Gaza, of course, it's not substantial, but yeah.
Matt, we've seen that China is trying to bring Fatah and Hamas together and to talk with each other to negotiate. And if this new manner of China can solve the problems between these two groups that are so important for the future of Palestine. And we've seen that China did it before between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And if they can achieve some sort of agreements between these two groups, is that going to make a good political move on the part of Palestinians to achieve a sovereign state?
I mean, it certainly would, if basically what being suggested to them is that China would be their guarantor, would be their backer. You know, the Chinese military is not coming and save them, but in the sense of like an economic backer as well as a diplomatic backer. Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. That makes complete sense for Hamas, Fatah, any of the Palestinian organizations or representatives. For the Chinese, though, it makes sense, of course, too. I mean, they're so under the barrage of Western propaganda. They're so attacked by it that any disparagement of the Chinese as siding with terrorists or whatever is just one more thing that we're yelling at the Chinese about. So, you know, they expect it to happen. And in this is an opportunity to insert themselves into the region in a position that makes it very difficult for the U.S., right? This complicates things. If China comes in on the side of the Palestinians, now all of a sudden the United States is not the biggest player at the table anymore, right? So it's a shrewd move in that way. It also, I think, provides China with the ability to not just be viewed as a peacemaker, as a deal maker, as some type of outside broker, but it also gives them the opportunity to do it, right? So if at this point the Chinese are able to insert themselves into the process, and then it can be determined that, look, it was when the Chinese came in that things started to really, at the negotiating table, that leverage that China could bring, that pressure, that weight, you know, that had an effect. You know, because even that right now you've got this negotiating table where you've got this, you know, 2,000-pound gorilla, the American Empire, sitting at it, and they're representing Israel. No matter what, you know, the United States protests about being an honest broker or whatever nonsense. So, yeah, I mean, so you could see the outlines of this in terms of Chinese involvement, how it would be beneficial for the Chinese, beneficial for the Palestinians, and beneficial for the region, particularly if China is successful. Right. And then that just then this gets back to what, you know, I was going on about earlier you know, the dismantling of the American empire. OK, now you're picking up for the Chinese to put this in, you know, something I despise, but relatively simple to depict, you know, the pieces of the chessboard. Right. So now you've picked up more pieces of the chessboard that you've taken that map and you've colored it more, you know, you know, the Chinese color in red than you did with the Americans in blue, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it will be interesting to see how the Chinese continue advance in this. I mean, I think many of us were so desirous of seeing a resolution to this. We hope for the Chinese to quicken their involvement, because not because we're China fans or because we, you know, any of those reasons, but because simply we want to see an end to this and we believe that they're the power that can do so. I think what you're seeing is you're seeing the United States gets back to what we, you know, I was going on about before about the poor decision making, right? And the making decisions in the short term that are often for a domestic political audience, say like Joe Biden's decisions with regards to the tariffs in China. You know, there's a variety of things that go into that, but part of it is he wants to be able to stand at the Democratic Convention in August and say he's done more against China than Donald Trump did, right? But okay, what does that do though? You know, is it actually going to have any effect in terms of helping the American economy? I don't believe so, because it's just got we've already got an issue with inflation, you know, and it's also in the culture, and I don't say the culture, but the I don't want to go down this path. I've already yammered so much in this session. But like you know, what you're doing though is when you're acting this way and when you're doing these types of coercive measures, right? These tariffs, right? You're giving, again, like we said about with the Russians, what other choice are you giving them? If you're not providing an opportunity, a table to sit at where they have a say and they have, then of course they are going to find their other measures, other means to get what they want, essentially. You know, whether it's for their benefit or others' benefits or some type of mutual benefit, and so you see that whether it's diplomatically in the UN Security Council, of course, last week, what was 143-9 that voted against giving more. It wasn't membership in the full membership, but giving more membership perks, if you will, to the Palestinians. You continue to see that type of behavior in the United States, in the UN, or their behavior towards other international institutions. But then this type of economic action, as well as, of course, all the military action, what does it leave the Chinese the desire to do, let alone the possibility to do, except act to build things that are in their favor? And so we see this here, with their entrance into diplomatic circumstances that, previously they weren't a part of.